Hi, Bobby Halton here for Unimac. Now, Unimac knows there's no price that you can put on a life, including ours. Being proactive with our health and safety is non-negotiable. To protect us against cancer-causing carcinogens, we need more than just clean gear. You need a total solution with the best equipment, the best technology, and the best training. That's why the good folks at Unimac partnered with an NFPA-authorized independent service provider to offer certified training on NFPA 1851 standards. When it comes to keeping us safe and healthy, demand the total package. Get training details at unimac.com/safety. That's unimac.com/safety.
Okay, good afternoon, good morning, good evening, whatever it is when you join us. My name is Mike Dugan. I am hosting today, and we are going to be joined by some of our regulars, myself, Daryl Liggins, and Bobby Halton. We have two guests joining us, and I'll let them introduce themselves. But before we start, I would like to give a shout out to the New Haven Fire Department, who lost a firefighter last night. And Ricardo Torres, and has another guy, Lieutenant Rankins, who is fighting for his life. Prayers for him, please, and for the New Haven Fire Department and all of their members. God bless them all. Our two guests today are going to be Phil Jost and Dennis Laguerre. Phil, if you could just introduce yourselves to our listeners, please.
Yeah, Mike, thanks for having us, and really looking forward to the discussion. My name is Phil Jost. I'm a, I was a deputy chief in the Seattle Fire Department. It's been a little over 30 years there. I'm retired now, and I was always interested in training. I've been doing training. I worked in the training division in Seattle, every single rank, and then instructing recruits and running the academy. And then as a deputy chief, I was also not just in charge of the training division, but I had another assignment where I was the shift commander for the city of Seattle for a couple of years, responding to and being responsible for every major alarm. I've been writing for and teaching for Fire Engineering Magazine and FDIC since 2004. And that's how I met and got to know Dennis on this article.
Go ahead, Dennis.
My name is Dennis Laguerre. I'm a retired captain from the city of Oakland, California. I had a 16-year line career, which was ended with an injury. I then, I got a bachelor's in vocational education late in life, started teaching at a college as an adjunct fire instructor. I've always been involved in training in my fire department all my 16 years line, whether I was receiving training or later in my career teaching as an instructor in the academies. There was a couple significant incidents that I was involved in. One in the city of Oakland where it was a line of duty death, and I was involved in kind of addressing hose and nozzles, which was listed way low as a contributing factor. And my heart has always been around water supply and water application. I wrote the chapter for water supply in the fire engineering handbook. And if anybody goes and reads that chapter, the paragraph about water supply has very directed language. I never use the word continuous in there, and we'll discuss that later. But ultimately, I started a consulting company. And for about the last decade, I've had the privilege of working in Canada and all over North America. I've done a little bit outside of the country as well, the continent here, mainly around fire stream application, fire stream development. And I had the privilege of working on the two UL studies, the stream study and the coordinated attack study as a technical advisor. So, I've built up a large body of knowledge, and I've seen and interacted with fire departments from rural to suburban to urban, and really with a laser focus on knowledge, training, and then equipment spec and how that all goes together is a system to apply water on the fire ground with the largest return on life preservation and property preservation. Obviously, number one's life preservation. And I think this article speaks to that, that Phil Jost and I wrote together.
Excellent. That's great. So we'll start the discussion, and I think we'll start it with some of the things. A lot of this came out of the April issue of Fire Engineering Magazine. There's a nice cover photo, and somebody I know, I don't know who the guy is, he's some moke, wrote a fire focus in the same magazine. But I would just like to talk about, if you have not read that article, brothers and sisters, it's well worth your read. And this discussion is going to be part of it. So does your department permit, allow, or encourage engine companies to initiate fire attack with tank water and rely on subsequent units to lay a supply line? So go ahead, Phil. Let's talk about this.
So when Dennis and I first started this discussion, you know, we're the bottom line, the base belief that Dennis can correct me, but we hold is that the mission matters, right? And if we look at the mission and we prioritize what we want to occur in the mission, then it's easy for us to say, give me just a second, I've got a plane flying over. But if life safety is the primary mission, then we should be laser focused on what we do from the moment that that fire starts, and whether we're talking about dispatch or turnout time or response districts, all that kind of stuff, right? And if you're taking an extra 20 or 30 seconds to do, then you're negatively impacting the mission. And the same is true in our belief of anything that delays the fire attack, from how long it takes you to get your face piece on, all that kind of stuff. And we lasered in on this article into whether or not you should be delaying fire attack in order to complete a forward lay with the first arriving engine, and bounded by the type of building being single family residences at the bottom end, or at the one side, to family dwellings up to three stories. So that's the types of buildings we're talking about: single families, multiple families up to three stories, where the first fire attack is going to be made from a hand line stretched from the first arriving engine. And so within that context, not commercial buildings, not high rises, et cetera, those can be a different discussion, but within that sort of single family, small multifamily, Dennis and I believe that to meet the mission is to get the fire attack underway as quickly as possible. And the way to do that is to take the first engine and put them in front of the fire building, have them stretch, charge, and operate off of the tank wall.
Okay. All right, Dennis, go ahead.
I agree with Phil's general premise here. It's one of the reasons I was involved with the article. There's a famous story. There's a famous saying. It's kind of been popularized as Mark Twain's, but it's not what you know that gets you in trouble. It's what you think you know that it's not true that gets you in the most trouble. Right.
That's actually Will Rogers.
Will Rogers, correct. It's funny. I've done this in a lecture before and said that it's attributed to Mark Twain. And a lot of people also believe it's attributed, correct source is Will Rogers. I've had difficulty pinning it down.
He published it in the New York Post while he was flying with Wiley Post. And he said, it's not what you know that's going to kill you. It's what you know that ain't so.
That's a good thing for a pilot, coming from a family of pilots, to know. So I'll defer to the chief there on the source. But I look at the triple combination pumper, and he Bobby sat on the editorial review for this, and I got in trouble here a little bit because I thought I knew something and wasn't quite accurate. Triple combination pumpers, call it triple because it has three things. As you know, as the chemical wagon feature, which is the rapid attack feature, the steamer pumps push water, and then the hose wagon feature, which is responsible for both supply and attack lines. And every station that was a true triple house used to have these three pieces. Now, I thought the chemical wagon predated the steamer. It's not true. Okay. The fact of the matter, I believe, and Chief Halton can correct me if I'm wrong, is that the mother invention is necessity. Okay. And steamers take a while to get up the pressure. You got to get a source. There's the bucket brigades, the old hand pumpers and everything. And somewhere after the steamers and hose wagons were invented, somebody said, hey, if we could keep these fires from getting big, we would have greater success once we get fire streams developed. And maybe now the technology exists where we can build a wagon that is chemically activated that gives us a pressurized stream. And those used to be very small. We're talking 60 gallons, 100 gallons, you know, 200 gallons, right? And that has evolved to the tank on the modern pumper, the chemical wagon feature. During our lit review, which Phil did, one of the fire departments back east that spent significant capital, I think they bought like five chemical wagons and then added them to their alarms. After a year, the chief came back and said, hey man, these chemical wagons are the cat's meow. They're putting out like 90% of our fires and our second alarms have gone down. We really enjoy these three piece companies. So it's obvious why the pumper has a tank and a hose wagon and a steamer. And I like each one of them to be respected. The taxpayer is paying for each function of that piece of equipment. They're paying for the chemical wagon. They're paying for the hose wagon. We know a lot of people don't reverse or split or do flying lays. And we know a lot of people don't put pumps on hydrants at large fires. So it came back that is my known through the fire service. If I work in an agency, which Oakland was one of these agencies where you have to stop and leave a member and lay forward with signs of smoke and fire, is my known factually correct? And if history shows the mother of invention was, hey, let's get these chemical wagons built when we already had all this other stuff. We had the hose wagon, we had the steamer. Why was the third component so important? And now we have the modern fuel load that developed so quickly and spread so fast, and we have tighter lots. Is it time to revisit best practice and start a discussion of time on the fire ground is non-refundable, fires grow quick, smoke is what kills people. Should the default position in these buildings, of course, there'll be exceptions to the rule. You pull up, there's a single family house on fire, it's stem to stern and two other buildings are burning, right? It's already spread to exposures, but we're talking room and contents fires, medium amounts of fire already on the exterior of the building. Is it best practice, life safety wise, to have the first company respond in and aggressively use their tank? And I think there's some good data and some really good results of agencies that have never given this up and done this for decades that speak to it. It's wise to consider this is a area of discussion that fire service needs to have.
Well, and as the head of the editorial board, I think it's important to point out that neither Dennis nor Phil are saying never lay in. That's not what they're saying. They're saying that due consideration should be given to the context of the fire and weigh that against policies that say always and never. In other words, what Dennis and Phil are pointing out is that there are organizations that say you will always secure. And that's a problem. Always and nevers are always a problem, which is kind of a funny way to say it, right? But if you think about it, precluding somebody from making a decision to go on tank water was, I think, the initial pain point. And those places do exist. I have friends that work in organizations that are steadfast as to you will secure your water supply. Now, I think there's an alternative there that we struck in an organization I ran years ago, operationally at Albuquerque, where we would, what we used to call loop a plug. So in other words, we just attached a strap to the 5-inch with the hydrant bag, and the lead pumper wouldn't leave a person, but they'd loop the plug, and either the guys on the rescue or the ambulance would hook it up so that a water supply was established to the first. And that was, you know, that was a nice Solomon-esque way to split the argument, right? So in other words, the line has been stretched, but we haven't lost personnel. We haven't lost a significant amount of time. If you looked at the hydrant spacing that we had, which was fairly standard, you weren't much more than, you know, 900 feet maximum to any fire location from a plug. So, and I think that's a great discussion to start having. The other side of the coin was, you know, tank water is what tank water is, and then backup lines, et cetera, et cetera. Like we were always backup lines should come from a separate pumper, because of pump failure or problems or water supply problems, which made great sense. And that's on a real interior attack. And so your policy construction is going to somewhat dictate your fire ground operations. But I think the article makes a great point about utilizing the pumper to its maximum capability in terms of life safety, which was the gist, right, of the piece. In other words, if you're going to get in and remove people, get in and remove them quickly. So it was avoiding unnecessary delay. Now, one of my mentors and tutors was Chief Tom Brennan. And Tommy used to beat me over the head all the time with one line: never trust anybody else to bring you your water. Just don't do it. So I kind of like the happy, for me, I'm a happy camper. I like the concept. I'm okay with people if they want to go on tank water. But what I worry about is just procedural memory versus retrospective memory. And when we write SOPs, we do it retrospectively. In other words, we consider an event, the context of a fire, we remember everything that happened, and we try to develop a plan that would best answer what we saw. And that's where we come with, well, if they'd had a more water available. So we write our plan retrospectively. Procedurally is stuff that we do. In other words, we hardly even think about some of the stuff. You know, it's like getting dressed in the morning, putting on your shoes. You don't have to think it through. You know what you're doing, right? The same thing comes with our basic skill sets as we move through the trade from, you know, journeyman to accomplished to master. And it just becomes what's called procedural memory. And that can also become ingrained to where, this is a true story. I had a great friend. He later became chief of our department. We had a super Walmart, one of those super Walmart joints, smoke showing, people leaving the building. And he rolled up and he said, "We're going in on tank water." Okay. You might want to think that one through. The context was off, but his procedural memory, under pressure, with stress, all that other things. And he was a great guy, an amazing firefighter, beautiful person, great guy. He won't mind if I give him, his name's Jim Breen. He's a great guy. Became the chief of the Albuquerque Fire Department a few years after I left. But Jim, one of the best officers I've ever worked with, just brain farted and went to procedural memory because he had other things occupying his, you can only make so many decisions under pressure. Anyway, he went with tank water, which obviously was, you know, the minute we pulled up, command level officers pulled up at the fire, because it was a working fire in a large structure. He looked at us and said, "I know." It was like, you know, yeah, I don't even need to hear it. I surrender, right? It was like, you know, he was like, I get it. He'd already, you felt like a priest, you know, okay, tell me your sins. It was like, you didn't have to do the opening line, you know, it was like, he was confessing. So I love the piece. And I think that the argument is there. And I'm glad we're having the discussion, right? Because there are places where people don't have any resource to say, "Hey, wait a second, let's talk about this. Let's look what these guys wrote. Two credible guys, two good guys. And they did some homework, and it's a good piece." So I strongly recommend people read it. If you haven't read it yet, shameless plug, Fire Engineering. And it also has a great fire focus by Mike Dugan. And please read that as well. So, which I believe, Dennis, honestly, I think if you read that fire focus, Mike, if I'm not mistaken, it initially attacked on tank water, right?
And that was the one where they had a weird building because the basement, they had used the basement as living space and they opened it up, no walls. They went in and the fire dropped
down. There was a guy on the roof spotted the basement window with smoke coming out of it. They've got 10,000 of those buildings, Phil, in that first two.
Evanston.
No basements. Yeah. That one had a basement.
And it was converted to living space, wide open, open staircase. So anyway, thank you, Chief. Go ahead, Daryl. I'd love to hear.
Well, I think, you know, there's a lot of different topics here. I think there's a lot of administrations that want to be able to CYA if something goes wrong by just ensuring that there's always, you know, a positive pressure water supply. But like Phil said earlier, that that's not really mission focused. And I generally think, including myself, a lot of firefighters are not quite familiar with how much water it takes to put out a, you know, a room, two rooms, three rooms, or even an entire apartment or, you know, residential space. It doesn't sound like there's any debate that we bring in a water supply or establish a continuous source of water for commercial buildings. And that may even include very large, you know, residential mansions or something of lightweight construction, if that's the type of area you're in. But the time lost, and take it from me, I'm not trying to throw my own organization under the bus, but the world I'm living in, as Dennis said earlier, is upon indication of a working fire, you are to establish a forward lay. I'm in a district very densely populated. Dennis and I worked together, you know, at the same companies when he was in Oakland as well. And it's a huge race to get to the scene. It's a race. I mean, something has to be unusual for us to have a charge line in place, flowing water and run out of water prior to, you know, that next engine there being able to establish a water supply. The other thing I'm contending with in a lot of my area is stretching to second and third floor apartments. That's very common. So there's two time losses. One is the engine stopping at the end of the block to drop the person off. And it may seem negligible. It may seem like, okay, that's only 30 seconds, but it's 30 seconds of fire growth. The other time loss I can face is now, even with four members on the rig, the engineer is always in the street, losing 33% of my staffing to help me stretch up to that third floor. That's going to be significantly more time loss or added kinks or something to the line. So, you know, generally speaking, we do not. 80% of the time, we are not forward laying. We have the engine going straight in, which is a breach of the rules. It's just, you know, one of those things that pops up if something goes very wrong. But rolling back the clock, when I was still in my former fire department in the suburbs, Redwood City, one of the last fires I pumped at, I made a mistake. We did a forward lay. I'm at the pump panel. We have a well-involved second story of a duplex. They stretch a line, fire goes out. And when we're shutting down the operation, I have a member go back and shut off the hydrant, and I go to bleed off, you know, the line, and realized I never opened the wheel to let water into the pump. I stayed quiet about it. I didn't tell anybody, but the lesson I learned from that is, well, we put that out off of a tank. I still had half a tank of water, and it was just an eye opener. And I know Dennis on the other side, looking at this scientifically, with the UL, it really shows that you can put out a very significant amount of fire with even small tanks. We run with 500 GPM tanks because we have a lot of hills and a lot of steep topography in our city. We can't really use larger tanks. But the other part is this fear of running out of water. And I know, I wish Isaacson was here to really speak on this. I have, in my experience, ran out of water. I do not think that it's the worst thing in the world. As long as you don't have someone committed to the interior without them having any knowledge that this is going to happen, it just happened at some surprise. But let's take this second floor apartment and I'm able to dump 500 GPM in there and have a significant knock on this fire. And yes, we have to continue pulling ceiling and wall and overhaul, but I'm going to make my searches easier. I'm going to still be able to contain the fire. We have paused this fire until we're able to continue with more water, but to delay that attack until we can establish it, I think is not going to be mission focused. And I still think dumping that tank in there is going to be mission focused, but a vast majority of the time, it's going to accomplish the mission of complete extinguishment.
Thank you. So I just want to give a quick shout out to Key Hose. Thank them for their help with this. So thank you for Key Hose as we talk about hose and supply lines and everything else. Again, one of the questions that came up in the article was under what conditions and what type of occupancy is the fast tank with the fast attack with tank water without first laying a supply line in permitted? Okay, and we kind of talked about it a little briefly, but let's go just a little more in depth in that because there are specific parameters that we use in this, correct? Go ahead, Phil, you're muted.
Yeah, and Dennis and Phil, just jump in anytime because it's like a union meeting and they're screwing us again. So you could just, whatever comes to your head, it's a conversation, not really a presentation. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's why we started with the problem is bounded to single family and small multifamily dwellings. I think in my mind, I would expand that even more. But I think it to get the discussion started, we have to have a place so we can stand firmly. And so that's why, first standing with one foot on the mission, right? And the mission is to save lives. And so, Daryl, you talked about, maybe we run out. But before we run out, if we use our five in these environments, if we use the 500 gallons like a craftsman does with his tools or her tools, we will completely eliminate the risk to the firefighters for sure, right? There will still be risk to citizens if we run out of water, but the risk for them will be smoke, not fire. And if we wait long enough to get a water supply, we could have another fire problem, but I'm going to offer you that if you use the 500 gallons properly, you have minutes and minutes and minutes, maybe 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 minutes to solve the water supply problem, during which time you can get your searches done. You can pull everybody out of the building if you had to, but if you can get in with 500 gallons, here's what I would say. If you can use 500 gallons to complete the search of that building, then you have completed the mission. Do we have other things we want to do? Sure. Do we want to put the fire out? Sure. Do we want to lose the building? No. But what's the mission? Right? And so if we can use 500 gallons right now to save those people's lives, then why would we wait 20 or 30? A lot of the discussion, and Dennis and I have been having this through Facebook and some other mediums, is, but we're faster at it than other companies are. Yeah, it might take you a minute to lay forward, but it only takes us 45 seconds. Okay, right? Can little Johnny or little Susie laying in their bed in their jammies waiting for you, can they wait 45 seconds? And if we focus on the mission, and then I say, okay, maybe are there situations to lay forward? Sure, these are not them. In my mind, these single family, small multifamily, stretching the first line off of the first apparatus, those are not the time to say, we're gonna delay fire attack by any amount. I don't think anybody in this group, or probably anybody on Facebook, would be saying to themselves, I'm going to accept it that it's going to take somebody to put their Facebook on is going to take them, or their face piece is going to take them 2 minutes. That's an acceptable delay. No, it's not. And it's a function of training, and we can get them down to the 15 to 18 second time frame with gloves on, right? But those same people are perfectly willing to accept a minute delay or a minute and a half delay and leaving a member behind at the fire hydrant and delaying fire attack by a minute, minute and a half. Is it okay for a rig to take 2 or 3 minutes to turn out from a fire station? No, right? So why would we accept a minute and a half to 2 minute delay, or even a minute delay, or even a 10 second delay for fire attack, when we don't know? If we expect fire and we expect victims, then we should expect fire attack to occur as fast as is reasonably possible, given that we're going to drive sanely and wear seatbelts and do all these other things, right? So I just don't get that part of it, waiting another minute is acceptable in these environments. And the question then comes back to, does it meet the mission? If it doesn't meet the mission, we shouldn't be doing it, or we should be figuring out a way to do something different.
One thing I think is underperformed in my area of the country, which, you know, as Chief Halton said, there are other methods, because we're talking about forward lay, and he talked about wrapping the hydrant. Is the stretch that Dugan had in his world, that backstretch can accomplish the mission of the first due engine, establishing a water supply without leaving a member at the hydrant, because you're dropping off your entire crew. That does require a static bed of hose. Dennis and I are obviously very large proponents of static loaded attack lines, but it does at times give the flexibility of dropping off the entire crew, and simultaneously as they're making the stretch and masking up, that rig is laying that attack line to the hydrant and accomplishing establishing a water supply. That's another option that may exist in some communities. It's not going to be, for example, a good option in our hills, because we can have hydrants 800, 900 feet apart. But in more densely populated areas, or if you have good hydrant spacing, it's something that maybe should be discussed. So it may not be an either or, going in completely dry with a pre-connect or laying in forward and operating off of a pre-connect. But if you're looking for, you know, if a static load will benefit you, or if it needs to be a little longer than it currently is, that's another play that may be availed to you if you employ that.
And very honestly, sometimes in my career in fires, good engine companies, they would do that, but they would also, because they were good engine companies, look at the volume of fire, and they would dump a second line on the ground before they even stretched theirs. They would dump one down and grab the other one and go. And now there was a second line there supplied. The backup line was already in front of the building. So the next engine company coming up already has a line. All they've got to do is say, we're ready for this line, we're stretching this line, we're ready for the judge. And that's a good, well-trained engine company, okay? And again, it's what you're used to and everything else. And I think it's a great discussion here, okay? The other question that we have in here is, consider this concept: the first arriving engine goes directly to the fire without laying a supply line and initiates attack with tank water. Second due engine lays a supply line upon reaching the fire scene, immediately dumps the tank water into the first arriving engine, connects the supply line to the second engine, which then will supply the first engine. Okay. And again,
so there's I love this conversation. And I think that, Dennis, do you have something first?
Yeah. Just a quick comment on what Mike just said, and also a little comment to Daryl, and it goes back to the editorial review I think some of the heartburn to get this message out correctly has to do with jurisdictional infrastructure and the type of fires that you're facing. Now, you look at the city of New York and you'll see 2-3 windows of fire burning for a long time before they get water up to the fire floor. Now, we know no one's going to charge a line and try to take a line to the third floor. Like, those are all dry stretches. And Daryl's point in Oakland, what I would argue in Oakland, is you're pulling up to a building fire, it's third story and above, and, you know, the hydrant spacing is 300, 500 feet. It's going to take you a while to get up and get your line flaked out and everything. And at that moment, like, the city of New York's default position goes back to mission. It goes back to, hey, we're going to stretch dry because of the amount of lengths that need to be stretched into a building that is very tall, you know, fire on the fourth, fifth floor, you know, single, no well hole stretch, you know, and don't worry, they're going to get you water. You know, like, they're going to stop and then drive the hydrant. But that is them focused on time, right? Going back to Phil's point, focused on time. If they stopped and laid hose to the front of the building and then did the stretch, and let's say there was enough room for inside, outside truck lines, so you're not really even affecting truck pavement. That means during the forward lay, guys wouldn't be going up the stairs. The fast thing for the city of New York, and probably Brennan's experience and other people, would be, hey, I want all my members involved in the stretch and only the chauffeur worried about water. If he gets a bad hydrant, another engine's going to help him. And they'll give us tank. So this goes back to that mission and time component. The tank, the thing that was just mentioned by Mike, the booster backup, right? I'm probably one of the few people that has the routine privilege of helping people change their hose bed and apparatus spec. One of the things that I've been doing for suburban and now some urban fire departments is taking one of the auxiliary connections and making it a tank autofill, right? I want to try to give members back to the fire ground. So when the second new engine, if the first engine's on in on tank and the second new engine dry lays forward or does whatever, when they get there and they give water to the first engine, they go to that autofill and automatically fills the tank. They just put the rig in idle and fills that tank. And then you put water in the second rig. And now that rig tank's full, right? People talk to me and they go like, Dennis is the anti-technology. He doesn't like flow meters. He doesn't like governors, blah, blah, blah. It's like, no, I'm pro time. Time is non-refundable on the fire ground, right? The other thing about going in on tank water and these bookend buildings, what's the officer on a three per, let's be realistic. Most fire departments are dealing with 3-person crews. If you go in and the fire is well within control of 500 gallon tank and you want your officer to give you a good size up, good rig placement, catch that basement fire, Mike, right? Catch that basement fire. Right? Do you want him by himself there with his firefighter back of the hydrant? Or do you want him not being able to help right away? Right? These are huge monkey wrench failures that have been repeatedly pointed out in significant events in line of duty deaths, you know, command and control, situational awareness. And if we look at the body of fire that is present in these buildings, and you look at the staffing that is showing up, front loading that response, I think, is not only pro victim, it's pro command and control, and it's pro firefighter in many ways. As long as what Chief Halton and Mike and Daryl and all of us are saying, like, if you look at the UL data and you look at the tactical considerations, no one's saying don't get a continuous supply. And here's shameless plug for fire engineering. Here's the water supply chapter from the Firefighter 1 and 2 handbooks. And I encourage anyone to go read the first paragraph in the water supply chapter. And I'm not going to read it verbatim, but I'm just going to paraphrase it. In nowhere in the first paragraph of this chapter did I mention continuous supply. I mentioned adequate supply. The supply shall last the duration of the incident. Let's be face it. Most people don't have hydrants in a large part of our country. They never get a continuous supply going, right? And I've had the experience, a fortunate experience, to see suburban, urban, and truly rural operations. And Daryl did a little self-reporting there.
often as an engineer, I found myself, the only thing I was doing with the positive supply that was established was refilling my tank after control. And I did come out once. I had a very senior engineer in Oakland after we put out a fire, and I heard the pump cavitating. And I look over, I go like, what's going on? Because we had a hydrogen supply and we're basically doing overhaul. We're well into overhaul, 15 minutes into overhaul. And then I see the person reach down and open, we had 3-inch supply at the time, open the auxiliary suction. They had never opened their supply. They did exactly what Daryl did. And that being said, I think we have to be careful here when we look at this data, right? When we look at this data, we know where the fire is. The well is, the line is well staffed. So what gave me comfort in going more towards what Phil was speaking, not only my experience in the rural area, is that it was substantially less than 500 gallons, right? And I want to be, I encourage you to go read the article. If you read the article, there is one experiment during the coordinated attack study that took well in excess. It took well in excess of the 140 gallons in the multiple family dwelling. Actually, if I have it here in front of me, it's in the article. It was experiment 5 at the UL coordinate thing, and it took 1,543 gallons, right? And it took, we did over 500 on interior attack and 900 on exterior attack to gain control of this living room space. Placement is key, right? We set this up kind of like the San Francisco line of duty death. We built this fire below grade, enclosed the stairwell. We knew it was going to be 2 turns to get down to the seat of the fire, and there was going to be no direct line of sight for the fire stream. There wasn't a single crew that tried to go down the stairs with the door open behind them whose gear didn't get saturated at the first corner. All of the crews had to leave the line flowing for their exited retreat. The Charlie side line on plane downhill, the first line pulled, if on your 360 you said, hey, it's a walkout basement, if they went down the side of the house and applied water on plane from the get-go, it would have been less than 200 gallons. Guaranteed, no problems, right? If you had access to that fire floor. So it takes knowledge and understanding and placement. And I think that's one thing the UL study is really giving. Good target flow, good placement, good use of water. And this includes good exterior water, and it includes doing interior water well, or knowing when not to do interior water. We want this tank water is precious, and we should know how to use it in the best possible way.
Well, there's a couple of things to talk about, to unpack. There's a lot to unpack in this conversation. One is that even in the rural settings, and I've worked in both, and I do work in both still, when you're looking at fire behavior and heat release rates, say you roll in and you're not in a hydrogen area, you're waiting for a drop tank and all that good stuff, and you've got a minimum 500-gallon tank, which is kind of unusual in people that handle rural areas these days. The 1,000-gallon tanks are becoming much more standard, which is an interesting movement evolutionary wise, right? But we have a saying in those areas, 500, because we used to hear people say, oh, we're doing a holding action, or I'm conserving my water until we get a water supply. Well, there's no such thing as a holding action in a fire. You're either putting the fire out or you're not. And if 500 gallons fast doesn't put it out, then 500 slow ain't the answer. Then you're at a fire that's bigger than 500 gallons. And that's pretty quick to figure out too. And the other point to take, and ancient wisdom is sometimes the best. And this saying's been around the fire service for over 200 years. You can find it in the London Fire Brigade writings from prior to Braidwood, where they say the best way to save people is to put out the fire. So, you know, you look at that, and I think we got some really ancient wisdom combined with some modern day data analysis that kind of brings you to a conclusion that context, again, drives decision-making. If you think you can get in there and do it, then do it. And now, could you be wrong someday? Could you get sucker punched? It could be the fire going here, kitty, 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 kitty. And you get in and the fire is worse. Yeah, we've all been there. And you realize, well, you know, then you make a tactical retreat, or you wait for the backup line, or you wait for water. You know, that can happen. So, I love the conversation. I want to get, as the ombudsman, I've got to do my duty. So I got to go to a couple of questions, things we're getting from our Facebook friends. And thank you from Brian Coates. He says he works in a volunteer fire department. And one of the departments that he works with mandates that they put somebody on a plug or a supply, and they're running on 2,000 gallon tankers, which is wow. That in our, my neck of the woods, that'd be a tender. That's a lot of water. That's a lot of water. The other question comes from my good friend, Bill Carey. And Bill is asking, how was the 30-second delay determined? Or is it just basically an estimate? How'd you guys get to that? And I think that, you know, I kind of just beat up Billy's other point is that we're not saying, you know, I hear people on the fire ground talk all the time about, you know, you do this, then you do this, then you do this, then you do this. Well, those are people that haven't fought a lot of fires. A fire is like a piece of orchestra music. There's a lot of things going on at once. And sometimes some things take preference, sometimes other things take preference, but, you know, sequentially it rarely happens on a fire ground unless you're really severely understaffed. Like if you're the first two engines, just, you know, two or three people, different story. But for most of us, unless you're really out in rural America, you know, you generally have 8 or 10 people to work with and you can do multiple tasks, you know, collectively to try to accomplish fire control. But to Bill's point, how did you guys come up with the 30-second measurement? How did you see that? How did you find that?
Well, in the article, what it actually says is, for an average crew on an average day, you can anticipate about a 1 minute delay if they stop to lay forward. And so that the difference between driving straight to the front of the building, let's use a single family as a mindset, but if you make no stops at all and you go straight to the front of the fire building and implement an attack with your tank water versus stopping some distance before having a member get out, go over, you know, pull the hose, wrap the hydrant, get back on, re-accelerate, then re-decelerate, right? So, you know, my estimation, I would say it's an estimate from, you know, a lot of time watching, you know, all my years in training, all my work as a BC, et cetera, with drilling companies and stuff. I think it is an estimate, but I think it's not a wild ass guess, right? It's based on a lot of experience. And I think some of the issues that we get into with this is, okay, it's not a minute. It's 15 seconds, right? What are you buying with the 15 seconds or 30 seconds or 45, or God forbid, let's say it's a minute and a half or 2 minutes, right? Worst crew, worst day, how long is it? And as an organization, how much delay is acceptable? Like we're sort of quibbling about how much, like, how do you know how much delay there is? And I would say, okay, I'm wrong. I would put the question back, how much delay is acceptable? How much delay impacts the mission?
How much delay is acceptable if your wife and kids are trapped?
You know, right.
So I think that's a great answer. Dennis, I do want to get to what I was talking about, flow rate. Flow rate, when you're talking about fire extinguishment, there's the answer.
Oh, I have two videos for you, Chief, that I sent the Pete. One is this was a hot area of debate during the Firestream study to finally unify the UL to target flows.
And I remember. I was there.
And if you remember, I left the room a few times. I'm probably one of the few people in America can actually get sales data out of all three major nozzle manufacturers. And people go like, how did you choose the nozzles? And I'm like, well, I just figured out, you know, I said, this study has to work for the existing equipment fleet in the American Fire Service and also where we're going, which rest is so.
Can you show those, Pete?
You know, rest his soul, but, you know, Brunicini had a big hand in getting us to what I consider a reasonable target flow. So there's two videos here. This one is the water's applied by tank. I pulled it up because it's very similar to the UL buildings that we in our acquired structure burns.
I would say this is a fairly heavy body of fire upon arrival. One thing that I do want to say is I'm not a huge fan of deck guns. You sacrifice too much placement of water. And it's, people often use deck guns in fires like this because they just don't know how much fire can be put out by properly placed adequate application rates. So I was involved with the Portland Fire Department encouraging them to pull 2.5-inch line more and to do 1.25, 1.125 tips. They were well on their way before I was involved, but that being said, this is a early success here. Just to kind of narrate this, when I give this class, I fall back on the National Fire Academy formula. I go, it's 3 parking spaces wide. It's about 20 feet tall, 2 stories. So I go 600 square feet, 600 divided by 3. 200 gallons a minute should knock this out of the park all day long. If you have a talented nozzle operator, it's going to leave the nozzle open. Really use stream reach and coat everything. Now, this is going to be 265 gallons a minute. But take a look. We already have 30 seconds go. Don't start the time now in your head. Wait till they get the line staffed up here. And here we go. Here comes the suppression. Okay. Very gentle movement in that first set of windows, sweeping the eaves. Nice coming back here. And this harkens back up to backup lines too. Backup lines can be smaller and more mobile than the initial line pulled. Like these rules that we've had, you know, obviously are disregarded by most firefighters in these cases because now we need mobility. But look at that. We're less than 30 seconds into the flow, 125 gallons a minute, right? 125 gallons total application, right? The deck gun would have wasted 200-300 gallons of water. And I'm willing to say that, not that I'm advocating for it, I think 1.75 at 160 gallons a minute with somebody really aggressive would have done very good there as well. So now I'm trying to recreate this at one of the UL studies. So now we're going to use a smaller application rate. This is a 7/8, 160 gallons a minute. And if you notice the title of the video, I spent a long time talking to the nozzleman here. And I said, I want lengthy bail open time. I want you to aggressively place water in a 90 degrees up, 90 degrees left and right fashion. I want you to walk up on the window. I definitely want you to collect the floors. And then I want you to go in and put out the rest of the fire. This was experiment 4B. It's on the chart that's in the article, in Phil Joseph's and I's article, in the Tank Attack article. It's experiment 4B, and the total application exterior is only 48 gallons, and the total application interior is an additional 95 gallons for 140 gallons total. Now, note, it's a well-staffed line, right? I'm not advocating that. Let's say it took double if you showed up with one person. You'd still be under 500 gallons. But note how important proper nozzle technique is to knock these fires out properly. So one thing in the UL studies, it's a constant critique from people that aren't involved is like, did you use modern fuels? Yes. Well, when do you time going inside? They wait until the highest heat release rate in the compartment has flashed that we're trying to get flashed. Right now, we're waiting for that living room. The kitchen's on fire. Okay, it's rolling out the first story, and we're waiting for the living room to flash, the balusters on Division 1 with the heavy smoke coming out of sliding door. So if we had the audio on, go ahead.
Sorry, what was the nozzle type and the flow rate for the video?
This is going to be a 7/8 inch tip at 160 gallons a minute, and they really measure it. Like, we really focus on getting it quantified so we can get this flow data. So they're using much better flow meters than what we use when we do training, Daryl. So, okay, the living room is flashed. We have probably at least 600 square feet, 500 square feet of this downstairs unit on fire. We might have extension in the second floor. Who knows, right? And we could have extension in the attic. So we're going to do everything we can. We pull up here and we're stretching the small line, right? So what can a small line do at a fire like this? So I discussed sweeping the eaves, walking up, not occluding the window, right? So here we go. He's going to take the eave. Now he's not occluding the window. It's going straight in. There's no problem with exhaust. We've studied this extensively. And he's going to pick up the floor. That should knock down the kitchen. So regrowth should be really low risk here. Now, we talked about applying stream here. I told him to go straight through the baluster. And if the second window has failed above, just try to get some water in that compartment. All right. Now, one of the things, it doesn't matter how much water you're flowing, the classic mistake made here, which is going to happen on the fire ground, if he had just pointed the nozzle at the ground for just a few seconds, he would have caught the couch, right? So no big deal. Notice how clean the stairwell is. Sometimes you don't want to go right in. If we had gone in and made this attack through the front door right away, it would have contaminated the stairway all the way up to the upper floor. So this is one of the places I would have advocated for the exterior water. Now they're going in. And the interior flow and move, which is the default at the UL, used an additional 95 gallons. So that entire fire was brought under control with 140 gallons of water.
That's what I love about both these videos, too, is this idea, right? So think about each of those fires. And you know, when I'm watching those guys, especially on the second one, right, they're standing by. It's a test, right? It's a study. They're standing by with a charge line waiting. And for me, it gives me anxiety to see firefighters with charge lines waiting to attack fires, right? Because I think that's crazy. Why wait? But the flip side is that if we're talking about a forward lay, and waiting another minute, what you're essentially saying is you don't want the guys there at all. In the Portland fire, you know, you might as well say, hey, you know what, let's wait a minute. Let's not even bring the engine in right now. Let's have them sit out on the street for a minute before they come in here and attack this fire. We would never accept that. And yet that's exactly the outcome if you're stopping to lay forward. And part of the difficulty in the discussion is that there is a history in the fire service of supply hose that's notoriously unreliable, of hydrants that are notoriously unreliable, right? That all of these systems, in many places, these systems got built to require these things because they were a necessity because the equipment was so poor, right? And now we just don't, across the country, we just don't have that problem. Have I been to fires where we had a problem with a hydrant? Yes, right? In all of my career, 3 hydrants, right? In the city of Seattle. And that doesn't count the fires I went to. That counts the fires that I know about, right? In the city, because these are major events. So do you set the system up for the outlier, or do you set the system up for the well-trained, well-equipped, group that is coming to that fire? Do you say, wait, there's a 1 in 10,000 chance that something could go wrong, so let's delay the entire fire attack to account for that outlier event? Or do we go with a 90% or a 95% solution that says, let's get in there hard, let's get in there fast, and understand what we're doing with our water, and recognize, right? Recognize that there is some backside risk, but that backside risk used to be a frontside risk. And in a lot of places, the decision makers, you know, they remember the frontside risk and just haven't recognized that now it's a backside risk, and they don't, the system doesn't need to account for it before the fire attack is underway.
Well, and I think it's a flawed construct to say it's an either or situation, right? To dovetail on what Phil was just talking about, there are going to be times when you lay in. There are going to be times when if you think you got a reliable, you know, backup, you don't. We kind of split the difference with the loop load. In other words, we had a 5-inch that you could just drop a lasso around the plug, drive off, keep your crew intact. The ambulance or the second two engine secured your hydrant, took care of their business, and, you know, got your backup. So I think there's a Solomesque way to do everything. And that, again, I'll go back to context drives decision-making. And SOPs, if you think SOPs are canonical, in other words, the Bible, you can't deviate from them, you're in a bad place to begin with. You know, in other words, your company officer has to be able to look at something. And in one of the classes that I totally love that Mike and I have both gone through is CAN class, where you get a 5-gallon extinguisher and a good officer can build up a substantial amount of fire for you to put out. And we've done it in real fires with just a 5-gallon can. So water is a very effective agent when it's applied, you know, at the seat of the fire correctly, to back up Dennis's point. You know, the problem for us in the real world, as we all know, is that it's much like when people talk about using a handgun or a weapon. They all assume it's in a perfect world where they're calm, it's a simulation, blah, blah, blah. Firefighting is done fast, dark, and dirty most of the time. Your visibility is limited, your understanding is limited. There's a lot more you don't know than you know, right? And so it's like everything else in life. At that point, you do everything you can to hedge your bets, you know, everything. And redundancy is the hallmark of a professional. You don't put all your eggs in any one basket. So we're not saying here that you can send one pumper on tank water to every fire. Don't walk away from this conversation thinking that's what we said at all. We're not saying that. We're just saying that it should not be against the law anywhere to have the first do roll up, not secure a plug, and go get a hit on the fire. That should be allowable based on that officer's judgment of the situation at that point in time. And just for case in point, I could take you back 12, 15 years in time before we started looking at DUEL studies about exterior attack. I don't care what you want to call it, transitional, whatever you want to say. I don't, exterior, on plane, off plane. You can give it any name you want. I don't care. But we used to call it giving it a dash from the outside. That used to be like against the law because you were going to lobster people. You're going to ruin the thermal balance. Well, now we've debunked a lot of that. There are times when it's absolutely critical to just hit it. You know, because you can't make entry unless you do it, or the fire spreading so quickly, and you can change the temperature dramatically by doing so. I do want to say before we leave, another quick shout out to our friends at Kehoe's who help us to do this. They're great folks. We love them, and it's a great product. If you're ever down in Dothan, Alabama, which is an absolutely gorgeous town, my buddy Chief Williams would love to see you. He'd love to have you stop in and visit the Dothan Fire Department. Lovely people. And my granddaughter, actually my goddaughter, Amanda, is there as well. And she'd be happy to take you for a tour of the plant and take a walk around with you in Dothan, Alabama, one of the largest hose manufacturing facilities in the world. Absolutely fascinating. They'd love to show you how they build the hose, how the hose is constructed. And you can learn a ton from those folks. Wonderful people at Kehoe's, a great friend of fire engineering. So I just want to throw that in before we end. Bill usually handles that part, so I didn't want to leave that off before we hit the hard stop. But, you know, we should question everything all the time. In other words, you know, anytime somebody tells you that this is settled, that's somebody who absolutely, there's a great line in the Bible, I think it was in Judges, it wasn't Solomon, it was Samuel. And Samuel says, the more certain anybody is about anything, the more it's probably true that they know very little about anything. So, and I think Locke kind of later said that the best are full of uncertainty while the worst are full of passionate intensity. So we're not saying any of this is all or nothing at all. What we're saying is that this is another way to look at fire attack. And what Phil and Dennis are saying is, if you really think you got a problem, if your assessment is that you got a life safety issue and that's our number one priority, here's a way to save some time and maybe rescue somebody.
Here's a little context for you, Chief Halton. I've gotten approval by the people at UL to basically use this slide. And when I teach with Keith Stakes, one of the UL research engineers, it's in there. And it's pretty simple stuff. Exterior fire requires exterior water. And in the end, interior fire requires interior water, right? So the video we watched where the 7/8 inch tip on that multiple family dwelling, people will say, well, they could have just gone in the apartment and put the fire out from the inside. A second line could have handled the exterior fire. Well, that would have dirtied the stairwell right away. It was an enclosed stairwell. So that was exterior water by choice, right? And a lot of the exterior water being advocated on the fire ground is by choice. So you should get a return on investment. Back to the person's question, the 2,000 gallon tank fire engine pulling up and being required to establish the supply. In the fire engineering water supply handbook chapter, I said adequate supply. You have a 3-inch tank to pump, a 500 gallon a minute application rate out of that 2,000 gallon tank, and you're pulling up to a 1,600 square foot ranch that's on fire or something, single story rancher that's on fire. That is adequate supply. If you can't put it out with that 2,000 gallons, it was too well involved when we got here. So it's again, harking it back to what you always point out, it's professionalism. And one thing that Phil pointed out that I don't think is well captured in the fire service is people who have bad experiences of not having a supply and a fire getting away from them. What actually caused that? Did they pull too small a line? Was the application rate not really a thing in their fire department? Should have they applied exterior water and they didn't? What other contributing factors tie into that bad experience? One of the things in the fire service that is true, de facto, is a fire department's not much of a fire department without water. Like if we have an earthquake in the Bay Area, have no water, you're no good to anybody, right? But you need to drill on maybe making an Iowa attack and keeping the vent profile tight after an earthquake and how to get the most water out of a damaged water main system. So when we talk about this tank attack, what I would advocate, especially for, I would say that the DC Beltway area, those guys are really good at getting that 3-inch on the ground and laying forward quick. And I would say that's an awesome evolution. But you got to remember, there's other fire departments like Philly that are on the East Coast where the engine goes straight in. So to be intellectually honest with yourself or with the mission, is what are we giving up and what times when we delayed, can I harken back to something where I was like, man, that person almost made it that we pulled out, or shit, if we had got water to there a little bit quicker, wouldn't it have been a floor origin fire? It would have been a room of origin fire, right? Because the flip side of the coin is also present. And that's one thing I think that true people that have mentored me that I respect greatly, the ability to think on both sides and to look at it in a way where if you don't look at an issue and you don't experience some discomfort, I don't think you can grow. Like, you know, and Aaron Fields did the discomfort lecture at the keynote, and it can't remember which year that was. Maybe it was 2018. At FDIC, but I think there's value in what he has to say here, and there's value in this tank attack article.
I think what you guys are saying is there's going to be a cost of doing business no matter what you do, and too many times policy saying to do a forward lay as if there's no negative to it, and if you're going to have these discussions, they need to be discussions and not argumentative. Not
exactly
emotional, but just fact-based. Either you're delaying to some degree, as Phil is saying, you are delaying to some degree water on the fire, or you're speeding up water on the fire to some degree, delaying a continuous source of water and deciding what is, what is best for your organization. And what's interesting is, we're coming from companies staffed with 4 or 5 or in Dugan's era, 6 members and still not doing, you know, sometimes forward lays. If you've got 3 on a rig, as Dennis said earlier, you're really arriving there with, you know, somebody that can't do much. I wanted to add a couple of practical, you know, not scientific, you know, time things, but just practical issues I've had over, you know, my career at the forward lay. But one is, I think that delay, what was asked about 30 seconds, I think it's greater, or 30 seconds or a minute. I think it's greater than that. When you're running up the street or up a hill or driveway with a 45 minute bottle on your back and your hydrant bag of tools to get up to there to finally make it to your, you know, crew to be part of that interior attack. It's a significant amount of time doing that to join them. And if it's a three-person crew, you're going to have to finally get up to your officer to be part of that. But a lot of times when we do a forward lay, we get up to the building and there was a closer hydrant. You know, sure, it sounds good to get on the mapping system or whatever. Sometimes there's just not that amount of time to go through all those steps. Or worse, we believe there's a closer hydrant and then we get in front of the building and there wasn't one. And so no system's going to be perfect, but I have experienced a lot more, not failures of infrastructure of hydrants, but, and certainly we have dilapidated cities that have a lot more than Chief experience in his career. But we have a lot of kids playing with water, and after the third time we go out there to turn off the hydrant, we have to shut off, we shut down it in the street. So sometimes we have taken forward lays, and that's when we find out that this is a bad hydrant. With the backstretch, when you lay out to the next hydrant, you're always going to be at the closest hydrant. And if that's a bad hydrant, you can then lay out from that or have that company continue to the next one. So there is some fail safes there. The other thing I just wanted to add before we go, those videos are money. I'm glad Dennis shared those. Watch those again. Too many times people will say they will not charge a 2.5 without a water supply. Watch the amount of time that's open. I don't know why somebody would refuse to charge a 2.5 without a water supply if they could have a positive impact on that fire. You just have to know that you've shortened your, you have a time compressed operational period that you can operate at, but your gallons per minute is more important than your total gallons flowed, and you could have a significant impact. The other thing is, watch the video again and look at the time of the fire growth and how fast that changes over 30 seconds or a minute, because that is what we're talking about at the end is, are we going to allow that type of fire growth prior to opening the line?
You know, there was so much to unpack in this conversation. You know, Dennis brought up hit and move. That's the fire ground. There's we could go on for 3.5 days, and I apologize. I've got folks waiting on me, so I'm gonna have to run. But a couple of things as the ombudsman, I would pay $1 million to be at the kitchen table tomorrow when Daryl comes to the table and the boys have the shutoff valve with the handle, and now it's called the Liggins valve because the little confession he made.
Over 100,000.
Dennis is going to be labeled as the traveling salesman for fire engineering books and video, which I absolutely love. Way to go, Dennis. There you got about at least 100 shameless plugs, not to mention the FDIC shirt, which is fantastic. I mean, you talk about a guy who knows marketing. I love it, which was wonderful. And all of these folks will be at FDIC with me in August. Please come see us. Dennis and Phil and I will be talking about fire flows and fire behavior, and Mike will be doing his classes. So please come see us. We'll all be out there in August and love to see you. The other thing I have to get with Dennis on is spelling and grammar. Now, knock is spelled K-N-O-C-K. Knack is K-N-A-K, which is, this isn't Twitter, Dennis. When we do overheads, let's make sure, just tease, I gotta get Denny a hard time.
It's my kryptonite. Spelling and grammar is my kryptonite.
All right, guys. Thank you all very much. We appreciate it. Thank you, Pete. Bobby, thank you. Appreciate it. We'll see you next month. Thank you.
Love you guys. God bless.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you.